The following program is being brought to you on the Voice America Health and Wellness Channel. For more information about our network and to check our additional show hosts and topics of interest, please visit voiceamericahealth.com. The Voice America Talk Radio Network is the worldwide leader in live Internet talk radio. Visit voiceamerica.com. The views and ideas expressed on the following program are strictly those of the host or guests and do not necessarily reflect the views and ideas held by the Voice America Talk Radio Network, its staff, and management.
Some people expect solutions to be expensive to be effective. This is not true. Everyone needs somebody who can be supportive and a guide. You'll find the answers you're looking for and the tools to both find answers and offer solutions on the Dr. Melanie Show. Now, here's your host, Dr. Melanie Barton.
Welcome to the Dr. Melanie Show on the Health and Wellness Channel at Voice America. This episode is the last in the series of honoring 8 different social workers for Social Work Month. Violence affects all of us. Associate Professor Janine Jones at Western Mexico University is an expert in domestic violence. She'll educate us about how to recognize the traits of abusers. The Sandy Hook Elementary School tragedy in December 2012 shook all of us to the core. It reminded us about how precious our loved ones are to us and can be taken from us in a millisecond. Winston Johnson, Director of Prevention Intervention Services for Hartford, Connecticut Public Schools, will inform us about how school social workers are being trained to recognize and hopefully avert such tragedies. First, let's talk to Janine. Well, I'm talking with Janine Jones, who's an associate professor at the Western Mexico University, who's an expert in domestic violence. So welcome, Janine.
Thank you very much.
Well, I asked around to see who would know the most, and your name came up. Did you know you were that famous?
No, I actually did not, but it's very nice to hear.
Yes. Well, all the things that we plan to do in our career don't necessarily happen the way we intended, and sometimes the things that we get known for are not what we thought we would be known for. So,
exactly. We often deviate from the path that we're on only to find something very exciting.
Yes. I don't know that we'd say domestic violence is exciting, but the work with the victims to help them get through that is exciting.
That's right. In fact, domestic violence is a very sad social situation all the way around.
Yeah.
For the victims, the children who mm-hmm. witness the domestic violence, and the perpetrators as well.
I agree, because I don't know about you, but I think it might be a brain thing that affects those who are the abusers, as well as, you know, maybe nurture versus nature. But I don't think that there are people that really set out to be abusers. I don't think they grow up and say, I'm going to abuse my spouse when I grow up.
Yes, I agree with you. I think that that truly we don't know. This whole genetics, and how much does genetics weigh against learned behavior? You know, I think we could all argue that forever. Mm-hmm. And the answer is we know that both have something to do with it, genetics and the learned behavior, especially from childhood.
Mm-hmm.
But we don't know the weight of each of those. So
right.
I think we just have to accept, okay, it's a little bit of both. We're not strict scientists, so we don't have to worry about what percentage.
No.
And look more at the focus of, okay, how can we help make this better? Or how can we help victims survive in a more humane way?
I agree. How did you end up working with domestic violence? What got you to this occupation?
As as a social worker, I started out thinking I want to work with kids. And then I expanded kids to families. And then I expanded families to adolescents. And what happened is I was amazed, although when I was in graduate school, you know, we were frequently told that if you learn the basic skills, you'll be able to use them with any population.
Mm-hmm.
So ultimately that is what happened. And in fact, just working with kids and families, you encounter domestic violence. In fact, unfortunately, there's no way to avoid it in our field.
Right. I agree. And it isn't always something you can tell from the outside looking in a family.
That's right. It can be very much hidden. Sometimes the batterer will make sure that any kind of bruising from hitting will be covered by clothing, for example,
mm-hmm.
So that there may be a woman who, you know, does not have a bruise on her cheek or a black eye, but she may have many bruises on her body, and that may be the design of the perpetrator.
And I don't know about you, but in my work with batterers and victims, I often have seen religiously rigid values. They'll take out of context the things they want to support their actions.
You know, I think if someone is trying to justify a behavior
mm-hmm.
that is hurting someone else or is not socially acceptable, that if you try hard enough, you can justify it at least to yourself.
Yes.
And maybe try with others. And frequently in the situation with domestic violence, the batterer does affect the victim, not only with the pain and violence, but also with the mindset
yes.
that this is the way it is. This is the way it's going to be.
Right. And I'm the head of the household. God's given me that right to be the head of the household. And so you have to obey me. And I know when I got married at 18, I had a Baptist upbringing, and that's what was ingrained in me, that whatever your husband says, that's what you're going to do. So, yeah, I'm glad it's not like that now.
Right. And it's a very tough thing to break. And it is still so intense, because even though we've gone socially through the notion of women's liberation and equal rights, we still have so much domestic violence.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I obviously work at a university, and I can't begin to tell you how many either employees or students end up being battered and need intervention
mm-hmm.
at some point.
Yeah, that's scary and that's sad. How do you educate social work students to prepare them for working with domestic violence? And I don't know anybody that says, I'm going to set out and do that kind of work, but maybe they do.
Mm-hmm. Actually, especially at the master's level, but sometimes even at the bachelor's level, we do have students who are focused. They come in saying, this is the population I want to work with.
Hmm.
Quite frequently, that's because they have either had personal experience with it or have friend or family members who have had experience. There's also an element of kind of subtle anger with people who are wanting to work with victims of domestic violence. It's like, it's that feeling, this should not be happening.
Mm-hmm.
I want to help make it stop.
I see.
And I think it's, you know, it's very much like any other social cause that people have, but we all connect, I guess, more with some than with others.
Mm-hmm.
What we do with students is infiltrate, if you will, the curriculum with information and education about domestic violence. So while there may be an elective course that just focuses on that, we also deal with it in when we're dealing with talking about human behavior, when we're talking about practice and, you know, how do you interview clients? How do you develop a relationship? So we work on the, you know, sort of, I call it the cognitive knowledge of the characteristics of a batterer, the characteristics of a victim, in some cases the characteristics of children who are witnessing. And then we also have to know, okay, so if you recognize it or you know it, what are you going to do? Right. Well, one of the first things is you've got to establish a relationship with the client that you're working with. And you've got to be very sensitive to not making any kind of judgment about that person, using what we call the strengths perspective, which is making sure that the client knows that they have some good traits, that just because they've been in a negative relationship doesn't mean they're a worthless person.
Right.
And then support, you know, being able to be a support, and I typically call it a client cheerleader, to help them get through the stages that they need to go through to be healthy again.
Uh-huh. Yes. And when I was working with women who said, you know, I'm going to leave them. And I said, you have to have a plan. You can't just say, I'm going to leave them. I said, you've got to have copies of birth certificates and immunization records and your marriage license and your insurance policies and bank statements. And they went, oh, my goodness. So over time, they would gather those documents and put them in a safe place. So when they left, even though it might have been in the height of a crisis, they were prepared.
Exactly. Otherwise, if they just leave, and let's say there may be children with them, everything that they've left at that house, they may not be able to get their hands on it again. They may not be able to recoup it. So, you know, we have situations where someone may have an infant, and, you know, they've got the baby and what the baby has on.
Right.
No formula, no diapers, no clothing. So in an emergency kind of situation, you know, sometimes just being able to provide the basics, you know, clothing, because it is so traumatic, and it's so difficult, because in some cases a batterer may use the fact that he has control of all of these possessions to try to get the victim to return.
Yeah. Well, let's, at this point, take a break. And when we come back, I want to talk more about what we can do to help and how we prepare social workers and some statistics. Okay?
Okay. Thank you.
Opinions, options, answers. You're listening to Voice America Health and Wellness.
March is Social Worker Month, a time to remember social work heroes like Nobel Prize winner Jane Addams, Secretary of Labor Frances Perkins, and civil rights leaders Dorothy Height and Whitney Young. They all helped make this nation great. You can too. If you're a professional social worker, the National Association of Social Workers provides a unique network of your peers. If you're thinking about becoming a social worker, NASW resources can help you explore your options. Social work is the profession of hope.
Opinions, options, answers. You're listening to Voice America Health and Wellness.
You're listening. listening to the Dr. Melanie Show with your host, Dr. Melanie Barton. To participate in our discussion this week, please call toll-free 1-866-472-5792. That's 1-866-472-5792. Or send an email to drmelaniebarton@gmail.com. Now, back to our program.
Welcome back to the Dr. Melanie Show on the Health and Wellness Channel of Voice America. Janine Jones, domestic violence expert, is teaching us about how to recognize domestic violence and how social workers are trained to work with them and protect themselves in the process. Let's learn more. I'm back here with Janine Jones, who's the associate professor from the Western Mexico University, and she's the domestic violence expert. So, Janine, let's talk about some characteristics of batterers and victims. What can you educate us about?
Okay. There are some traits that we find with the victims. Mm-hmm. They tend to be individuals who are eager to please, mm-hmm. and who, given certain circumstances, can be controlled. Although I probably do need to add that given circumstances, I think any of us could fall into that category.
Oh, I agree. Yes.
The batterers tend to be people who are very controlling. Mm-hmm. It's not unusual for us to see substance abuse involved also. Mm-hmm. There are a number of situations where the batterer may be, may have what we would call normal behavior regularly, but if that person drank too much, mm-hmm. then they would get angry and violent.
Mm-hmm. Is generally the batterer somebody that they've witnessed it themselves in their growing up?
Absolutely.
Okay.
I think that's where we fall into that learned behavior mm-hmm. concept. Mm-hmm. That, you know, we all learn the appropriate way that we're supposed to act. You know, in school we learn how to stand in line mm-hmm. because that's what we're supposed to do. If we go to church, we know we're supposed to be quiet. In this case, whenever there is any kind of anger or frustration and a child witnesses the battering, mm-hmm. then that's going to be their first reflex on how they are going to handle it when they are adults.
Mm-hmm.
It's also interesting that the impact on children, I think, is greater than we may have realized in the past.
Uh-huh.
And there's been a study that shows that of boys who are, or young men, between the ages of 10 and 20, okay, of that set who murder someone, mm-hmm. 63% murder the batterer of their mother.
Mm.
So I think that gives us an idea as to the significance of growing up.
Yeah.
In a situation like that, and the boy's desire to either protect mom or get vengeance for mom.
Yeah, and oftentimes when I would work with the battered women, they would not leave the environment until one of their kids tried to intervene and got hurt, and then they could, you know, get unstuck and do something.
I think, you know, it's amazing how much pain an individual can take when, you know, if we're talking about a mom here mm-hmm. and concerned about caring for her children and supporting financially her children, how much she can deal with both physically and psychologically.
Mm-hmm.
But let someone... injure their child. And I think we see that, that maternal instinct frequently come out. And mm-hmm. it's like, that is stepping over the line.
Yes.
Say, you can do what you want with me. Don't hurt my child.
Exactly. Yeah. Can we define exactly what domestic violence is? Because people may not, you know what the parameters are.
You know, we used to define it very narrowly, that mm-hmm. basically it was a situation with a husband and wife, and the husband physically hurt the wife
uh-huh.
on some kind of a regular basis.
Right.
Well, now we realize that, you know, we have couples that are heterosexual, homosexual, and this battery, the domestic violence, goes across any kind of intimate relationship.
Mm-hmm.
So it can occur with any type of couple. We also have expanded from just the physical hitting, which you can see the results of,
right,
to realizing that you can psychologically batter someone just by the way that you deal with them and the words that you use.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And so we have, you know, we have individuals who generally with the violence, it starts out verbal.
Yes.
And then gradually escalates. Mm-hmm. And then, unfortunately, sometimes it gets so drastic that the victim ends up being killed mm-hmm. by the mm-hmm. violence.
Now, it used to be, this may not be true now, but the violence often, it escalates from the verbal to the physical when the woman becomes pregnant.
There is a higher risk factor.
Mm-hmm.
When the woman is pregnant,
mm-hmm.
There are some theories as to why that is the case.
Mm-hmm.
Perhaps, you know, it can be anything from a cognitive notion that, you know, the male didn't want another child.
Right.
But it can also get spread out into the batterer saying, oh, you've been out there having an affair.
Ah, yes.
That's not my baby.
Uh-huh.
And so that gives him additional reason to be angry and to batter.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Sad. Yes. And for some of these women, they get out of one relationship and don't know how to behave any other way and how to protect themselves, and they get right sucked back into a relationship with someone else very similarly.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's not unusual for a woman to go, you know, from one batterer to another in her lifespan. I worked with a girl once who had been, she was 11. She had been removed from her home because the battery that of mom's boyfriend to mom,
mm-hmm.
that had gotten out of control, and the child, I think, accidentally got hurt.
Okay.
But it was enough to bring in child protection services.
Mm-hmm.
And this 11-year-old who was in foster care, and I went to see her one day, seemed so very wise, because she said to me, you know, this isn't new. My mom always picks these kind of guys.
Mm.
And when I asked if she could, you know, explain that to me, she was able to name off two husbands and then three boyfriends over her 11 years that were abusive to mom. And none of them had gone beyond being, except for the verbal
mm-hmm.
abuse. They had not become physically abusive with the kids until this last instance. And what ultimately happened is I worked with the mom and the daughter for a year and a half, and mom ultimately could not break the pattern.
Oh.
And would not stay away from the perpetrator.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So her parental, after a year and a half, her parental rights were terminated. And that 11-year-old went into an adoptive home.
And I hope that that was a much better environment for her, the 11-year-old, I hope.
Yeah, in fact, it was. She was adopted. She got two brothers,
mm-hmm.
and a new mom and a new dad,
yeah.
and a dog and two horses. And she thought that you know, it was still emotionally difficult, but there was no corporal punishment in that home.
Mm.
No people getting so angry that they yelled or threw things.
Mm-hmm.
So she developed a sense of safety.
Wonderful.
And after probably about 8-10 months, she said, "At least I know that whatever I do here, I may get grounded. I may lose privileges. They may be irritated with me, but nobody is going to hit anybody."
Yay. Wonderful.
Yeah.
Well, you've given lots of hope to say that, you know, you can do something. It doesn't have to be that way. So I truly appreciate the work that you're doing, and I hope that people will go do some research, and if they think they're in a relationship that might becoming abusive, to go do something about it.
Absolutely. And there is, all around the country, there are hotlines for domestic violence. Most of the time, those have somebody answering the phone 24 hours a day, 7 days a week.
Okay. Well, I need
so that if someone is in a situation, doesn't know what to do, they can call.
All right. Well, thank you so much, Janine. This has been very helpful, and let's hope that this interview helps somebody to stop something that is going to harm somebody.
That would be absolutely wonderful, and that is certainly our goal, is it not?
Yes. Thank you so much, Janine. I really appreciate it.
Okay. Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Bye.
Bye.
A healthy dialogue for your lifestyle. Voice America Health and Wellness.
Are you, or is someone you know, struggling with life? Do you know that your subconscious beliefs play a big role in the outcome of your hard work? We can help you to permanently change your beliefs that may not be in alignment with your goals. We care about getting you a return on your investment. We can help you reach your goals easily and quickly. Contact us at BeliefMantra.com. That's BeliefMantra.com.
Do you have or know someone who has multiple sclerosis, Lyme disease, or any other chronic illness? Advanced Cell Training is a restorative self-healing modality that I, Dr. Melanie, have had phenomenal results with, reducing physical symptoms I've had for over 20 years. This process can be done right in the comfort of your own home. Request their free DVD at AdvancedCellTraining.com. That's AdvancedCellTraining.com.
You're listening to The Dr. Melanie Show with your host, Dr. Melanie Barton. To participate in our discussion this week, please call toll-free 1-866-472-5792. That's 1-866-472-5792. Or send an email to drmelaniebarton@gmail.com. Now, back to our program.
Welcome back to the Dr. Melanie Show on the Health and Wellness Channel of Voice America. Janine Jones educated us about domestic violence. Now, Winston Johnson, the Director of Prevention Intervention Services for the Hartford, Connecticut Public Schools, will tell us how social workers are being trained to recognize and hopefully avert school violence tragedies. Let's find out. I'm fortunate today to be interviewing Winston Johnson, who's the Director of Prevention and Intervention for Hartford Public Schools, which is a big issue these days. So welcome, Winston.
Thank you. It's my pleasure.
So there's lots of things going on regarding schools these days, but you've been a school social worker for a long time. This isn't something your first go around.
That's correct.
So what led you to becoming a school social worker?
Well, it's interesting. I happen to work in the community I grew up in. And over the years, I had an interest in working with youth and had had a number of individuals coming to me feeling that I had answers to questions that I didn't appear to have, so I thought. And it kind of led me to trying to explore more about human behavior. Mm-hmm. And so after undergraduate school, I decided to venture into looking into social work. And as I was attending the school social work program at UConn School of Social Work, I did a field practicum in a school and then in a group home. Mm-hmm. And as a result of that, I began to work with young men, particularly that had been involved in the juvenile justice system.
Oh.
And, yes, and I got a job as the rehabilitation coordinator for the Catholic Charities or Catholic Family Services, and I ran the corrections program for 6 years.
Hmm.
And after doing that, felt the need to go back and catch folks before they went the criminal justice route, which led me to my interest and determination to work in the Hartford Public Schools, the same school district I grew up in.
Okay. Was there any social worker in your upbringing in the school system that you had contact with?
No, not at all. In fact, I don't even think I can recall a social worker in my school district while I was attending school.
Hmm. Okay, so maybe it's a recent phenomenon. I don't know.
Mm. Yeah.
I didn't have one in my school growing up in Michigan, mm-hmm. so maybe it's something... I'll have to explore the history of that and find out.
Yeah. So, well, one of the things, because this is school social work, well, actually social work month,
mm-hmm.
One of the things it will be interesting to know that between 1906 and 1907, school social work originated in the city of Boston, New York, and Hartford.
Oh.
And it originated out of the visiting teacher.
Mm-hmm.
And what had happened was a number of youngsters may have been out on illness or medical situations, and they sent a teacher to the home. And I imagine at that time it was to help them with their academics. And as a result of that, they began to uncover a number of problems and situations that were stemming from their home environment, and the evolution of the school social worker evolved out of the visiting teacher.
Hmm. That's interesting, because as a junior in high school, I thought I wanted mm-hmm. to be a teacher, so I went and volunteered at the elementary school next to my high school. And I got so wrapped up with the children that were not performing, and the teacher was yelling at them, and I talked to the children and found out one little girl had been up caring for her siblings, because apparently her dad mm-hmm. was alcoholic, and
yeah.
she was
uh-huh.
hungry. And she didn't yeah. sleep, and so she was falling asleep in class and couldn't work. And I said to the teacher, I said, but this child has a reason she can't work. And she said,
yeah.
that doesn't matter. If you're going to be a teacher, you can't be concerned about that. And so that day, on that moment, I decided, I'm not going to be a teacher. I'm going to be somebody that helps these kids. And I did, and I do.
Wow. Well, there's that evolution, and you uncover a lot more when you have those personal relationships and find out really what the roots of things are.
Yes. Yes. And that you can make a difference and turn it around.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Mm-hmm.
So what actually does a school social worker do?
Well, I think one of the things, and because I provide oversight and I work in the universities and training social workers, one of the things that I think is extremely important in terms of what their role is because social workers are trained in systems theory and behavior,
mm-hmm.
Is to really take a look at the school environment and being able to function and help youngsters to address the problems that interfere with their education process. And the roots of those could be issues that come from the home, come from the community, that come from the school community, relationships, medically related issues, disability related issues, communication related issues. And the school social worker's job is to kind of help the students to navigate a system given all of those risk situations and help them to resolve some of them or to better cope with them so that they can really learn what's going on between that relationship between the teacher and the student.
Well, a question that I have is that as a psychotherapist, if I treat a child, I've got to have permission to treat the child, mm-hmm. to work with them. In the school
yes.
system, do you have to have permission from the parent or whoever the legal guardian is for you to do anything interaction-wise?
Yes, you do. Initially, if it's a crisis situation, you may respond to the crisis and inform the parent of the root of the crisis. But in order to continue to work with the student, you certainly do need their permission.
Okay. And what happens if you don't get it, but you know that this child needs it?
Absolutely. Well, one of the things that I continue to stress the fact of then you would really, my objective would be to help a parent better understand the need for the intervention by the school social worker. So it may mean to try to develop a relationship with the parent mm-hmm. to better understand how you can help them help their child.
And do you?
So it does belong to relationships.
Okay. Do you, as a school social worker, go out and visit the homes? Are you allowed to do that?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, I didn't know of safety factors and all, whether that was allowed.
Well, a combination. In many instances, you may have a parent that will come.
Mm-hmm.
And then you have others that you may need to negotiate a meeting place if it's a volatile neighborhood. Or the other is to make outreach to the home.
Mm-hmm.
And one thing that's interesting now with the social network, there's so many different ways that you need to develop the skills to communicate with parents through the Internet, through cell phones, through tweeting and, the texting. And it's amazing how folks are communicating in today's networking.
Mm-hmm. It's good.
Yeah.
It's very good.
Yeah.
Sometimes it's an overload. You get...
In many cases, you're absolutely right.
We're trying to multitask when really we can't. So.
Yeah, and a lot of times you're on emotional overload as a result of how much is coming at you.
And that's true of the kids, too.
Yeah, it is. It really is. And that's one of the concerns with the social network is that because of the way students are communicating, their social skills are really falling short.
Yes.
Writing skills as well in some instances because of the texting and the short words and the spelling and things of that sort as well.
Yes, I had a student I do a volunteer at a school of the arts leading a creative writing workshop. And I had the kids write their first name because we were going to analyze it to see what it said about their handwriting. And one of the students who's in sixth grade said, "I don't know how to write in cursive." And I thought, oh, my goodness.
It's really scary, isn't it?
Yes, it is. Yes, it is. But there was a discussion I heard on a radio program that said, do we really need cursive anymore because of technology? So that's a whole other issue we'll take up.
Yes, it is. Yeah, it really is. And that's what we're seeing as a result of technology. So, how necessary are some of the foundations of education that many of us got that folks are abandoning. And I think that some of that has a lot to do with the issues that kids are dealing with on the organizational structure-wise in educational systems as well.
And you think
right
about,
on down to discipline.
Right. And you think about the unfortunate cases where some youth have committed suicide because of what was said on technology, on Facebook.
Absolutely.
And
absolutely. And the way it is said and how it gets. Yeah. And it takes on a life of its own.
Yes. Yes. And what is in the social media is not necessarily based on fact, but people
That's
take
correct.
It that way. And then.
Yeah.
You can't take back what's
out
there.
You sure can. Once it's out there, you're right.
It's like the old visual image of if you say something, you gossip about somebody, it's like distributing the feathers out of a feather pillow. You cannot go gather them all back.
That's correct.
So, yeah, that's difficult. Well, I think it's a good place for us to take a break right here. And when we come back, I want to talk about the violence in schools today.
Okay.
All right.
Okay.
So let's pause and get quiet, and we will take a break.
A healthy dialogue for your lifestyle. Voice America Health and Wellness.
Like 30 million other Americans, I have interstitial cystitis, a chronic inflammatory disease that feels like a bladder infection or prostatitis for men. Desert Harvest Concentrated Aloe Vera helps. It appears to give analgesic properties while coating the bladder. It's the only one that has a phase one trial. It's whole processed, whole leaf, and extremely concentrated. Go to DesertHarvest.com to order or call 1-800-222-3901. Tell them Dr. Melanie sent you. 1-800-222-3901.
Opinions, options, answers. You're listening to Voice America Health and Wellness.
You're listening to the Dr. Melanie Show with your host, Dr. Melanie Barton. To participate in our discussion this week, please call toll-free 1-866-472-5792. That's 1-866-472-5792. Or send an email to drmelaniebarton@gmail.com. Now, back to our program.
Back to the Dr. Melanie Show. Welcome back to, and it's on the Health and Wellness Channel of Voice America. So we're listening to Winston Johnson, and he's talking to us about school violence. Let's hear now about the Sandy Hook Elementary tragedy. I am back here with Winston Johnson, who is the Director of Prevention Education for the Hartford Public Schools, and I'm glad to be talking to you with especially all this trauma that's been in the news media about the violence in schools. And is it my assumption or is it correct that there seems to be more violence or it's just more reported now than it was 20 years ago?
You know, I think it really is a reporting wave in terms of the way we get information and the fact that through the media is repeated so much that it does have the effect of appearing to be a lot more than it is. Mm-hmm. But it is has increased. I would also agree to that.
And do you think it has to do with there being the mass media that people who do this kind of thing are get excited about, you know, the potential that they're going to be known by what they do?
Well, I think it's a combination. One is the way we glorify getting attention.
Yes.
And the range of the ways we get it.
Mm-hmm.
And the fact that our response of not being able to walk through or talk through or mediate problems and lashing out and trying to resolve them in a quick manner and, you know, so to speak, put a period on and end it, mm-hmm. rather than to problem solve seems to be a quick fix for everything.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Have you been successful in talking to anybody that you perceived was a potential threat to talk down?
Well, not talk down, but I think the calming down. I think one of the things that the tendency for, and I say particularly a lot of young men, is the self-talk.
Mm-hmm.
And oftentimes if you even approach someone that's on the verge of losing and angry, you can almost hear them mumbling or repeating to themselves over and over again before they commit a real violent act. And sometimes catching that and engaging them in conversations allows them to calm down. And I say that in respect to having broken up fights in school and things of that sort. And one thing I always repeat to the youngster that's really hyped up when they'll tell you pretty much, don't put your hands on me and hollering and screaming and I'm going to get this person. And I just continue to repeat, calm down, relax. And get them out of the repeating of what they're going to do to somebody repeatedly. Because what it does is it fosters a belief that I'm going to act on what I continue to say to myself. So sometimes interrupting those patterns are extremely important.
Plus, it gets those stress hormones flowing. Yeah. And they're saying that repeating it over and over again. And that boost of energy can put them into action. So, yeah.
Yeah, that's exactly what happens.
Mm-hmm.
And then if you add, you know, power of a gun or a weapon, it just it escalates.
Yes, it does. And it's scary.
Yeah.
So parents, you know, live in fear now. Do I homeschool my kids? Do I accompany them to school? Do I help pay for a school guard? What do you recommend that parents do?
Well, one of the things that I've looked at this from a variety of different aspects, because after 9/11 I was engaged in some of the profiling training and the do's and don'ts that the FBI had administered to different school districts, and I really support the fact that students needing to have an adult that they can go to or someone they can talk to or somebody that they have confidence in a school setting. So I continue to remind parents of the importance of helping the kids to understand that they need to try to talk through an issue and go to someone to help them mediate before they have to act on it.
Mm-hmm.
So I think one of the things that's extremely important for parents to understand is that problem solving and conflict resolution really begins in the home, and acknowledging that adults are there and should be there to help you mediate situations that you feel are beyond your ability to control.
Mm-hmm. And it's scary for the teachers, too, because you don't want them to carry a weapon. I mean, that's not going to solve the problem, but you don't want them to be injured or killed in the process either.
Yeah.
So it's hard to know.
Well, the other thing is for teachers to not appear to be afraid of their students.
Yes.
And that requires you to engage in conversations with them early before there's a problem.
Yes.
And so I think that's an important piece as well.
Well, it used to be that teachers had respect, that they could discipline students, and that's not normally the case now, is it?
Well, I think one of the things that I've observed over the years is that teachers that have respect still command that respect on a variety of different levels.
Okay.
And what tends to happen is students react to the teacher that shows disrespect, and it's pretty consistent. So when you have teachers that have problems that constantly show up, if you've had a chance to observe them and watch how they interact, it has everything to do with their relationships.
Okay.
And so teachers that don't have that problem consistently don't have that problem. So I think that we do have to take a look at how teachers talk to students, their proximity to them body-wise, whether they violate students' space, and how they talk to them, and their body language are all very important areas that some teachers do a better job of than others.
Mm-hmm. I like the probably controversial show Glee because it addresses so many of these issues with kids.
And
it looks at it from probably a more liberal viewpoint than many parents would like. But I like that they aren't afraid to address these issues.
Yeah. So. Well, you certainly have to figure out a way to confront the issues because they don't go away.
Right.
And if you don't develop skills to navigate them, they continue to resurface and become very volatile and very threatening to the school environment.
Yes, I agree.
Yeah.
Well, let's talk specifically about the situation that happened in Connecticut. How do people recover from such a horrific event? Because I couldn't even watch the coverage on TV. It was just too horrific for me because I am a visual person, and I every time I hear about it, I just pray for the people.
Yeah, yeah. And I know for myself, because I was personally involved and was on the phone with one of my colleagues who lost a niece in the shooting, and how painful it was as I was speaking with her while she was at the fire station waiting to hear. And I think emotionally, socially and emotionally, it's so hard emotionally to comprehend the level of that incident that really just changed many folks' lives.
Yes.
And it's really scary to think of just what those youngsters and those adults were going through at the time.
And you know, and I know, that those children won't ever be the same. There will be the element of innocence is lost. So what kind of continuing care is there for the victims and their families?
Yeah. Well, one of the things, and I just recently reviewed a DVD with my staff around childhood trauma.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things that they emphasized that the recent research has showed us that even youngsters that have had trauma in early childhood, brain can change and they can heal with love and nurturing.
Okay.
And one of the things that I think is extremely important is that the body has a tremendous capacity to heal itself.
Mm-hmm.
And so sometimes what we need to understand is that by creating a nurturing, safe, orderly environment, helps the brain to heal. And so one of the things that we can do in schools and helping teachers and staff and administrators understand that for the amount of time that students are in a school setting, we should make it as safe and orderly and as nurturing as possible, and eliminate as much stress on students as possible, which also allows their brains to heal.
Yes, yes.
Yeah.
And taking them to a new environment rather than back into the building that it happened
Absolutely.
In. Is that more healing than going back to where it was and trying to reframe it?
That's correct.
Okay, good.
Because your body is a human tape recorder.
Yes.
And it just plays back that which is recorded, and you have to change the script.
That's right. That's right. And the cells in our body are the memory recorder as well, not
absolutely.
Just the brain.
Absolutely.
How do schools, do they have a means to recognize the potential violent students? Is there some kind of characteristics to look for? Are they trained in this?
Well, I think one of the things I've emphasized, at least in the Hartford schools, is in the state of Connecticut, we're all required to have school-based prevention teams or crisis teams.
Mm-hmm.
And the one thing that I think is extremely important is for the teams to get together and talk about the pitfalls in their schools, the high-risk areas, and look at different scenarios that are happening across the country and play them out in their prevention team meetings.
Okay.
Rather than to wait for an incident, but to say, what would we do if this happened in our building? What preventions do we need? What physical adjustments do we need to make? And how do we train our staff to be physically, emotionally strong? Because kids, model the adults.
Right. Right.
And so I think the focus on, training a team to respond responsibly and understand that everybody plays a role in supporting, protecting kids and creating a safe and orderly environment, and that everybody can do something to ensure that everyone feels safe.
Okay, good. Now, are you training social workers in social work graduate school how to deal with these kind of things?
Yeah, it's interesting. Next week in one of my classes, the topic is school-based crisis teams.
Oh.
And what we do is we review the roles, we look at different scenarios, and then they get a scenario and have to respond like a crisis team.
Good.
And really is to help them better understand the role of a multidisciplinary team.
Wonderful.
And And I think that that's important to recognize that there are so many different roles that are needed. And I'll give you one quick example.
Well, we are running out of time, Winston.
Oh, okay.
So we'll have to save that for another future interview. Would you be willing to come back and talk more about this?
Absolutely.
All right. Well, thank you so much, Winston. This has been very helpful, and I hope people will go back and listen to it again. So thank you.
Thank you.
Well, now it's time to wrap up today's show. If you're in a relationship that has some characteristics of battering, please go get some help. And talk to your kids about healthy ways to express their anger. Next week, we're going to talk with Frankie Picasso, who is an author and a life coach. Please like my show on Facebook, The Dr. Melanie Show, and go to my website, thedrmelanieshow.com, and sign up for my newsletter and order my books. And I want to give a shout out to engineer Brad Comer, assistant director of host services Randy Jackman, and my executive producer Tacy Trump, who've all helped to make this show work today. So remember, to help yourself, help someone else. Until next week, goodbye for now.
Thank you so much for joining us this week for the Dr. Melanie Show. Please join your host, Dr. Melanie Barton, again next Thursday at 10 a.m. Pacific Time, 1 p.m. Eastern Time, on the Voice America Health and Wellness Channel. We'll see you next week for another great program.